Hi folks, before the podcast starts, just a quick plug to ask you to support us. How you do that is you join us on patreon.com/tortoiseshack. It's the price of a fancy cup of coffee once a month, and it keeps these mics on and ads free. There's lots of extras for there. There's lots and lots of benefits and exclusive podcasts and additional content that you get access to for that $5.50 a month. And it's a great time to try. It's the beginning of the month, so you get it. There's no contract. You can literally try it for the month, see what you think. And if you think it's value, it just rolls on. If you don't, you can just cancel it. So I'd ask you, maybe try it this month. Try it for May. See what you think. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Now, enjoy the podcast. Thank you.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Tortoiseshack Sunday special. It's nice to be back. It's nice to be joined by a familiar face in Shamim Malakmian from the Dublin Inquirer. It's great to be joined by first time guest on the Sunday show, but also well known to our listeners, former prison officer and whistleblower Noel Magree. And Martin is here.
Still here.
Yeah, listen, it's been a very, very busy week, a lot to cover. But as usual, Shamim continues to do some brilliant work in the Dublin Inquirer in relation to the immigration beat and how things have been covered. And Shamim, I actually saw you pointed out one of your stories has been picked up by elements of the far right this week. And it's pretty disheartening, disappointing. But do you want to just, before we even get into that, do you want to just tell listeners what you are covering this week and why? By the way, folks, again, it's great work. Support the Dublin Inquirer if you can. But Shamim, just if you could give us a rundown of that story, that'd be great.
Yeah, so we were kind of wanted to look at what happens if someone comes to Ireland and say, my house has been destroyed by the impact of climate change. So we looked at, I looked at the IPAT archives, which is the asylum tribunal. So when I searched climate change, five cases popped up, but two cases only directly were related to climate change, and both of them were refused. So we've kind of then looked at the research from other countries and realized that basically in Europe, it's not recognized being a climate change, being a victim of climate change, it's not ground for seeking asylum. And the reason for that is that they all kind of refer back to the UN convention, refugee convention, which was drawn up to give people refuge from the Nazis initially, you know, and it covers persecution. And for example, for refugee status, you need to be proved that you're going to be subjected to persecution. And for subsidiary protection, you need to prove that you'd be subjected to serious harm, and that is defined as degrading treatment and punishment. And when these people had kind of presented their cases, they've been told that one of the judges at the tribunal, tribunal members had basically questioned the reality of climate change even, you know, and said, for me to kind of give you refugee status or subsidiary protection, I have to accept that climate change is real and it's man-made and it's being done intentionally, you know. So they were saying that if people are burning fossil fuels in some other country that's impacting your climate in your country, it's too much of a stretch for me to accept that this is true and that this is being done intentionally. So the tribunal member basically said, if you go back, be deported back, even if you be subjected to serious harm as in degrading treatment and punishment, it can be the impact of gross recklessness as opposed to something being done intentionally, you know?
Yeah, and it's terrifying to hear that so clearly, because we've seen so often now in what's become sort of not so much climate denial as climate kind of obfuscation, you know, this kind of idea that we'll put it on the long finger. And I mean, I think it was Ben Shapiro who famously said, look, people just move over time and they'll get, you know, they'll leave their homes and they'll get new homes. And clearly, you know, the borders are going up. And, you know, I don't know if you saw the reports during the week of the work that's been done by Sea Watch of 41 people not surviving, going into the water and not coming out, and the heartbreaking reports that are coming there. And then you have to recall that was something that alongside the EPP, members of the far right, the Fidesz party, and that that our own MEPs in Fine Gael voted for only a couple of years ago. And that is climate. People are fleeing climate emergencies now because we're seeing shortages in crop productions, and we're seeing the weaponization of hunger. Can I ask, from a legal perspective, though, is there anybody fighting the case on climate grounds that supports the people who are applying?
I haven't seen it in Ireland, and unfortunately, the problem is, I don't think these cases went to the High Court, so we never got a chance to see what is the opinion of the judges in the High Court or the Court of Appeal or even the Supreme Court, you know. And I suppose the one thing that I have to point out is these are people who can't afford really these cases to kind of get lawyers to go to the High Court, and the legal aid doesn't really cover going up for judicial review to the High Court. So yeah, and as you pointed out, over 20 million people just in 2020 have been displaced by the impact of climate change, you know.
That phrase, gross recklessness, I mean, that's kind of worrying, I think, Tony, because, I mean, genuinely, that is what's going on. They are being grossly reckless. But how does that leave them not culpable of anything? You know, I don't get that. If it was a car you were driving, gross reckless is enough to put you behind bars.
Well, if I can say, there was a successful case taken, and I know they lost the case overall, but they were given grounds to take it by, I think it was the people involved in Keep It In The Ground, about saying that this generation are endangering their generation by gross recklessness with the climate. So it's making its way through the courts to become sort of legally recognized. But as Shamim said, when you've got 20 million people displaced by it now, I mean, I'm seeing stuff coming out. Like we speak to the Global Alliance of Tax Justice, and who are, you know, there's a lot of them based in the global south, in places like Kenya, and they're talking about hunger now again. We've spoken to people about hunger as a weapon now in Ethiopia, and we've seen what's happening. And that is all of a part. Look, I mean, we were supposed to be, we were hoping Hannah McCarthy would join us from Beirut. She's having problems connecting. They are suffering huge issues with the price inflation on food. And it is very much, Shamim, I suppose, we talk about Fortress Europe, you know, not allowing people in when it comes to these things. But also now what's happening on the flip side is we're hoarding the wheat and grain that's needed by these other countries that are suffering from this. And it's a double whammy. And no one's really talking about it because they're just saying it's as if this famine is that's coming is just an accident rather than man-made and not prepared for.
Yeah, absolutely. And you said, like in Yemen, I talked to someone from Yemen who had two cousins pass away from the impact of famine, and they said that because people's crops aren't also growing because of the drought, so that's also exacerbating the impact of climate change. And I was at a webinar recently, and they were talking about how when marginalized people suffer more from the impact of climate change, because you have a situation, if you're well off or if you're connected to the government or somehow or wealthy, you'll be more likely to get government assistance when a natural disaster hit, you know. And you could say that would count as some form of persecution. But as the tribunal member said, that would that's a brave but convoluted argument, you know. I don't know.
But I mean, like, just before we move on, Afghanistan has huge food insecurity, and the US is sitting there withholding the money that actually was, you know, it was the Afghani government's funds, and they've withheld the money, saying, well, we want to punish the Taliban. But all they're doing is starving people by withholding that money. And NGO after NGO are reporting that. And again, it's okay. And what's happening in Ukraine is inhumane. It's barbaric. And we have to be very cognizant of that. But we also tend to lose sight of these other conflicts and the impact they're having. And I just think, you know, it's great the work that you continue to do, but how do we make people sit up and actually say, climate change is not something that we can say, you know, oh, we've 3 years to fix this, we've 10 years to fix this. It's happening now. It's happening now across the globe.
And if you look at India, Tony, the ground temperatures in India this week are killer ground temperatures, absolutely killer ground temperatures.
50 degrees in some parts.
Yeah. killer. And, you know, we're all culpable in that one. And when you think about turf bans and you think, yeah, we are all culpable in that one. You know, but then again, within our own country, you can't say to people, look, you've got to suck up $3,000 extra that you don't have because, you know, we want you to. That's not a solution either. So, you know, it's very difficult unless you have buy-in from the wealthy set. If you don't have buy-in from them and if you don't support people who can't afford to transition, then this is just going one way. And it is gross recklessness. There's
I want to come back to the pod I did a few weeks ago with Eric Lonergan and Corinne Sawyers about that their book Supercharge Me, about actually making these things an incentive to people by making making it cheaper to change, making the alternative cheaper. And how they put it, and it's a phrase that I think should start getting put around all the time, is the people who will lose out are three different types of organizations, shall I put it. They call them the thugocracies, the theocracies, and the 1%. And yeah. I don't think anybody would mind in the majority of the world to see those three areas actually get a kick in. So I think we have to start thinking like that, as opposed to the idea that, you know, we'll pay for it from carbon taxes or whatever aggressive moves you have. But Martin, you did make a point, and I want to just say it. It's on the Red Sea poll today. 68% of people say quality of life has been reduced because of inflation.
Yeah.
63% little to no disposable income. 73% are trying to buy cheaper food, and 50% are dipping into savings. I know people are saying, you know, not even anecdotally, people are paying for routine things on credit cards again now. And this is where it's all starting to bite in our reality. But that, on the flip side, is just because, you know, we have lost sight of the wider context of it. And I'll be coming back to it this week with hopefully Derije from the Global Alliance of Tax Justice in Kenya. So hope to go back to that this week. Look, I know you want to move us on.
Yeah, and thanks, Shamim. It's a really great story. And you are great at digging out these stories and putting them out. That is a great story. I'm going to move over to Noel, and Tony mentioned thugocracies. But yeah, Noel, there's been a development. The action you took as a whistleblower has now precipitated some kind of investigation. Just give us an idea what kind of investigation it is now.
Yeah, so the Public Accounts Committee were sitting this week, and they had the Prison Service and the Department of Justice before them. And one of the matters on the agenda was what was referred to as the COSI report into the prison mess committees. This had been published in early April. So Deputy Imelda Munster of Sinn Féin, who's on the Public Accounts Committee, she set it out quite clearly, where she said that concerns had been brought to the attention of the Public Accounts Committee through a protected disclosure made by a whistleblower, and she identified me as the whistleblower. They had requested an investigation to be conducted into the concerns I raised. Helen McEntee, as Minister for Justice, appointed COSI to conduct this investigation, but they excluded me from the investigation. So they investigated the concerns I raised, but they didn't involve me or speak to me or allow me to be part of the investigation. Nonetheless, the report produced by COSI upheld and substantiated a lot of the things that I had said. But like a lot of these reports, the devil is in what they don't say rather than what they do say. So if for a moment, if we were to park all the fancy language, and there's a lot of repetition and stuff like that in the report, if we were to park all that for a minute, what it basically, what the COSI report basically found in simple terms, if we put aside the label Prison Service Mess Committee, what you're basically talking about is a restaurant, okay? It's a restaurant to serve the meal needs for the staff in a prison. There's 9 of these within the prison service. So this restaurant has no property costs. So it has no rent or mortgage or lease to pay. It has no, it doesn't pay for gas or electricity because that's supplied by the prison service. It doesn't have to pay for any equipment. So all the cooking equipment, fridges, freezers, that's all there already on site provided by the prison service. They have no staff costs because the mess committee, the restaurant, is run effectively by 2 prison officers with the assistance of about a dozen prisoners. So none of those incur staff costs. It was found that these restaurants are VAT exempt. So they don't pay VAT, they don't pay any tax. So on top of that, basically what you have is a turnover or a sales of approximately each one of approximately up to 300,000 a year. So obviously the larger ones were taking in up to 300,000 a year. The smaller ones would take in something less. And the only overhead that this restaurant would have was the purchase of food for meal prep to sell as a meal. What Cozy found was that the vast majority of these restaurants were insolvent. There was no money in the accounts. In one mess committee, in one restaurant, we found where 44 checks had been written and had bounced. There was no money in the account to cover the 44 checks. So the money was gone. Now, Cozy doesn't address that matter because they can't speculate. So what they looked at was they couldn't answer the question of where is the money gone, because there was no accounts kept, there was no audits kept. So you have this nine restaurants in the prison service. This is occurring across the board. It's raising serious questions, but the response from the prison service and the Department of Justice is nothing to see here. It's not public money, it's prison officers' money paying for their meals. That's kind of muddy in the waters a little bit, because they're ignoring the fact that it is public money that's paying the staff costs, paying the property, paying the gas, electricity, paying, you know, providing for these things to exist. But they're claiming there's nothing to see here because it's not public money that's effectively missing and unaccounted for.
Noel, is there a sense that this investigation could get to Kubono? Who benefits? Who's where's the money going? You know, follow the trail. Is there a sense that it will get to the end of this?
No. It's been put to bed by the prison service. They would introduce, and again, what I'm saying here is in this Cozy report, they've introduced measures deal with the issues that were raised, or at least in their way to deal with the issues that were raised. And again, this is part of the problem. I would have raised these issues from, say, 2013. There's reports in 2017 that kind of highlight what I was saying, or that I was saying it. You get to kind of 2019 before anyone starts to listen to me. 2020, I lost my job. 2021, the minister decides to appoint this investigation. 2022, the report comes out. So you're talking a long time. So there was an awareness of this. So there was an opportunity for people to put things in place. So one of the measures that would be progressed by the prison service as an answer to this, you know, is that they've done away with cash in the prison restaurants, the staff restaurants. So you no longer pay by cash, you only pay by card. And this is proclaimed as an answer or a solution. What Cozy found was that there was a substantial amount of refunds. Money was paid back from the prison restaurant bank account into prison officers' cards without any explanation. Nobody knows. There's no accounting, no record of why or what this money was reimbursed to them. So, you know, you can see where removing the cash solved one problem, but there's another problem cropping up immediately and they're just ignoring it. And unfortunately, that tends to be the way it goes with these reports.
What do we need to finish this off, Noel?
Well, look, what I would say to you, I suppose, first of all, is there's a bigger issue here. You know, I'm one person. Because of what I was saying, because of what I was doing, I was never promoted or allowed up the ranks, you know. So I always remained a pretty basic grade prison officer, and I've done my best to flag matters and raise concerns. What we have seen in this week alone, you know, is that the inspector of prisons, whose job it is to do some of the stuff that I'm doing, and I have to say was very good at it and was a very good inspector of prisons, was forced to resign because of the pushback and the lack of cooperation that she received. She's done a very, very important report into matters in the Dorcas in the female prison. Minister Helen McEntee came out this week and said that she's not going to publish that report. Now, you know, you've got to ask the question. This is a report that's funded with public money to investigate a public service that, again, is funded with public money. And those people involved, those public servants, have decided that you and I don't need to see that report. We're too stupid, or we're too whatever, to understand what's in that report, and it's withheld from us. And I find that really wrong. That report is public property and should be made available to the public.
No, thanks again. You do so much good work, and I know in the background that the work you are doing is phenomenal, utterly phenomenal. And a big shout out to Whistleblowers Ireland, because we all work together to help each other out. So, Noel, thanks very much. Stick with us, Noel. We'll come back to you. But that's very revealing, and thank you very much. Tony,
Before we move off, Noel, if you haven't heard Noel before, go back and listen to the podcasts we've done with him in the past. They're up there now. It's really eye-opening and disturbing how he's been treated by the state, including a Minister for Justice, previous Minister for Justice, and then Taoiseach, and how his protected disclosure was treated, and how his second protected disclosure was then treated, and how effectively he lost his career for doing what he does. So Noel, I do want to say publicly, we do really appreciate you continuing to stick with it. I don't know where you and your wife get the resolve from. It's a credit to you both and your family. I know you're here, but I want to thank her as well, because she's a star. I want to talk about a couple of things that are interesting.
Just before you do that, Tony, I just wanted to say what Noel said about the report being paid for with public money and that this should be made public. That links back very clearly to what Roderick O'Gorman did in the Doyle this week with women in the mother baby's home, and saying that you know, pulling the patriarchal card and saying, you know, you might not want the information we'd give you, so we won't give it to you. You know, I mean, and that is pure patriarchal governance. That is, I mean, that is the absolute problem. And that also links in that we see an article in the Indo yesterday saying about how the Justice Minister has a lot on her plate. And yet Martin Beans Ward this morning has put up videos of women who are in homeless hubs. My God, those women have a huge amount on their plate compared to what the Justice Minister has. But all of this reporting should be in the public domain, including what Noel is talking about, including what Roderick O'Gorman is denying women. And also that when it comes to reporting, reporters should actually be reporting on the stories. If women have it difficult, the women in homeless hubs have it most difficult. Let's be really honest about this. They're locked up and institutionalized like we've done with women for decades, and it's absolutely disgraceful.
Yeah, I am on the Roderick had a really bad week, let's put it that way. The idea of saying, you know, we won't tell you about the thing in case you don't want to know about it on your file. Survivors who we know, who've been on these podcasts and we've worked with, and the legal representatives were again hurt by this, and that should not be the case. He also had a terrible week in terms of, and Shamim, you might have seen this, I'd like to get a comment from you on Aramark getting the contract for catering services for Ukrainian refugees. I mean, this is a company that we've known since at least 2015 had been providing shit service, like that's, and that's being polite about it. There are documented cases of what we would call inhumane practices by their catering services.
Yeah, I've gotten legal threats from them before, and I don't think I think they've gotten to the stage that they can do whatever they want, and I don't think they're going to lose any contracts, you know, because of all the backlash or anything. It's just that, as long as I think direct provisions out there, and they're going to keep profiting off it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that you got legal threats from them, first of all, it doesn't surprise me. Mm-hmm. But the fact that like we're to continue to pretend that this didn't happen, I remember years ago when we, one of the early podcasts, Martin, with Ellie Kasambi, who was in Direct Provision Centre at the time up the road from us, and she was doing her own Ellie's Kitchen type stuff, and the crap she was getting just from them as a, because she's like, oh, well, actually I could cook, I can cook better, I can provide food, and it was, you know, very much made things very difficult, and they've been able to use that to silence people. But the idea that the government then said, had the nerve to tell us, Roderick O'Gorman particularly had the nerve to say that, you know, oh, the Ukrainian thing is an exceptional circumstance, and we, you know, we didn't have the tendering process because we just had to make do with the quickest thing possible. We have known for at least 7 years that this company has been abusing people. I mean, we're from the US prison service has had to distance itself from it in certain states because of feeding people food with maggots in it. We've seen the things, we've seen how it's going on, and it actually is horrendous that that is actually considered an answer to us, and we're all supposed to just move on that, oh, it's Ukraine again. Same as Dara O'Brien this week saying we're behind on our housing list because Ukraine again. Nonsense. You know, you don't get to keep pointing at that and saying that gets us off the hook. It goes back to Shamim's thing around climate change. Imagine if we can't deal with this, how are we going to deal with the challenges we're going to really face?
That is really the thing. And you, even if you look at COVID, you know, and we have the solutions, we have the tools, we have the wealth, we have the capability, but we've decided we can't really fix
but
this.
Can I say something that I didn't hear anybody point out, right, on the turf issue? I understand we have to move away from fossil fuels. Absolutely agree with 100% that we have to start doing that, and in a quick way and doing it properly. But isn't it interesting to keep going on about clean air, and they wouldn't spend any money on HIPAA filters when we were talking about clean air during a pandemic?
I know. And also, you know, if you want to get people out of cars, the subvention for transport is what, about 300 million at the moment, Tony?
About 360 million. And so if we made the whole thing free, the loss to the state would be about 240 million a year, which is, you know, which is actually less
than the fines.
Exactly. And actually, Ireland isn't getting fined now for missing its climate goals, because what we're doing, instead of paying fines, is we're buying
derogations. Yeah.
We're buying carbon credits from developing countries, which is just another predatory practice, by the way. You know, that's all that is. It's outsourcing our responsibility into developing nations, and then therefore they can't actually develop, maybe if they want to, because we're saying, well, actually we need you to not touch that land, because that's Dublin's land now. It's just, the whole thing is gross when it becomes a market. I did want to give ourselves a little bit of a pat in the back, Martin. If you remember, a year ago we had the debt collective from the US on student debt,
and they were brilliant, and we had them on, and they were looking at student debt, and they were looking at it, you know, from all different angles, how the controlling factor of it, the race, the class, everything is tied up in student debt. And, you know, there's no reason for student debt, Tony.
What they pointed out, what was really good, was that with a stroke of a pen, President Biden could get rid of it.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of, I don't know if you saw, but the talk is he's going to do that up to a level of, say, maybe $25,000 per student, and then these people are no longer students. These are working people trying to probably pay back more than they have. And it is predominantly minority communities that are carrying these debts. He's been accused of politicization because it's coming up to the midterms. So what, I say, right? But the other thing that's interesting is that the company that manages the majority of student debt, and this was revealed by Aoife Grace Moore and Paul Hosford this week, again, a year ago by us, but anyway, saying nothing. but is Maximus, and Maximus recently tendered the Irish government for looking after return to work and labour activation schemes, as they call
indeed
them.
They did,
Access to the government. The other company that we're currently providing the service, we're told you don't bother even reapplying. Imagine we're turning around with a company that's literally been accused of driving people into early graves in the US, and we're saying, yeah, we'd like to set you up here in Ireland to help us with our almost full employment, because there's a few people we'd like you to bully.
That is it in a nutshell. And if we look at how job activation was activated the last time round, we now see that there's reports that, you know, it wasn't worth the money, and all it really did was hound people unnecessarily. That's all it really did. So now you're bringing in the guys with the big boots on to do an awful lot of kicking on a very small group of people who have many reasons for not being at work that are not down to being lazy. I mean, if you look at what Martin Beans put up this week and those mothers trapped in there, oh my God, how could you do anything else but be subservient to the powers that are kicking you all the time? I mean, it's just disgraceful stuff. The Department of Social Welfare, Tony, as you well know, is one of those departments that has to comply with any rules. We'll talk about that next Sunday. But as you know well, Tony, it does not feel it has to comply with any rules.
Yeah, we've seen, actually, this might be a question for you, Noel. We've seen over the course of the last couple of weeks, unaccountable civil servants. I don't want to go to that meeting. I don't want to attend that. Sure, it wouldn't be reasonable for me to talk about that. You've come up against that bureaucracy for the last number of years. What does it look like when you're seeing someone who's on 300 grand a year saying, sure, I don't even want to go to that committee to answer for what I was or was not involved in?
Look, the first thing is the titles that are used. They talk about public servants and civil servants, and they're neither civil nor do they represent the public, to be quite honest. They're only representing themselves. But just to get back to the point you were making about direct provision and Roderick O'Gorman and making the reference that Aramark were appointed without tender to deal with the Ukrainian refugees. You know, this is not an anomaly. This is something that happens all the time. And again, it occurred at the Public Accounts Committee session on Thursday, where my COSI report was discussed. Matt Carty raised the point that when the Department of Justice had control for direct provision, they had awarded 91 million euros worth of contracts that were not compliant with government rules and not compliant with procurement rules. That has now been transferred to the Department of Children under Roderick O'Gorman to handle direct provision. So when Matt Carty asked the question, you know, how or why this 91 million euro of contracts were not compliant, what was done to address that, the answer he got was, oh, direct provision is not under our remit anymore. We don't answer questions on direct provision. If you ask Roderick O'Gorman's department, what's he going to say? He's going to say, well, I didn't appoint those contracts, the Department of Justice appointed it. So you're not going to get any answers, you're not going to get any accountability. But similar to what was raised over Aramark getting the contract for Ukrainian refugees, you have 91 million euro of other contracts that were awarded without the proper tendering or testing or compliance. And nobody's going to get an answer on those, I'm afraid, because these people they operate in a way, I love the phrase, lessons have been learned. The lessons that are learned is how to isolate us, frustrate us, confuse us, and do anything but give us the answers we're asking for.
That phrase, lessons need to be learned or have been learned or should be learned, it's always directed at us. It's us that needs to learn the lessons. It's not them. They've shown they're never ever going to learn the lessons. They depend on us not learning the lessons. That's where they really depend.
Yeah.
Sorry, just want to, like, we want to move on again, but there's a couple of things we forgot to say. Were you supposed to say at the outset, Martin, that wasn't it amazing what Katie Taylor pulled off last night?
And you have to really like Katie. She just keeps the head down and she battles on and nothing stops her. I just admire that. She is just singular in her motivation. She just pushes. She is relentless, I think is the right word. She is. And I love that about her. Love it about her.
It's phenomenal. And it has to, at this stage now, whatever, we always do these, you know, hierarchies of who's the best of all time and all. She's in the debate for the best Irish sports person overall of all time at this stage.
I think she's the best woman boxer on the planet.
No. I just mean you can talk about it also. It's just phenomenal. But I woke the dog woke me at 3 o'clock. So I was lucky enough to actually say, oh, you know what? He's woke me now. So I'm going to watch it now.
Isn't,
you know,
that funny. I was up at 6 o'clock this morning Friday morning with the dog, because the dog was sick. I was up at 6 o'clock. Somebody had to bite the postman, you know.
So it's usually you. But no, look, we've actually some stuff coming this week, Martin, that's going to be of interest.
I wish I could tell you more, but we just can't. And we just can't. Noel, little wink to you. You know a little bit about this, so a little wink. But no, there's stuff coming this week. So absolutely keep your eye on the tortoise shed. Midweek-ish. Well, in around there.
Oisin, can I come to you? This is not news to me. This is a point that you raised with me on email during the week. But we have time because Hannah's not going to make it from Lebanon. So I wouldn't mind if you could just give us a little bit of an insight into what you were telling me was happening during the week.
Yeah, no, it was just yesterday or the day before. another coroner's inquiry into death of a mother in childbirth at a hospital found, recorded a verdict of medical misadventure. And like, this is an area that I have to make clear now, this is not my area. It's just, I grew up with it because this is the thing that my ma has been involved in with colleagues of hers for like ages now. And in particular, there's a group called the Elfin Collective, which is
your mother literally wrote the book on this, so
she. She's one of them. Yeah. She would hate it if I gave her all the praise, so I better not do it now. Otherwise, she will.
I will.
But so the thing of it is now is like she rang me and told me about it just this week. There's two more cases that have been found out, and since the alteration to the coroner's, I think it's now the amended Coroner's Act 2019. If a woman dies in childbirth in a hospital, there has to be a public inquiry. So far, there have been 13 coroner's inquiries going back to 2007. Every single one of them recorded verdicts of medical misadventure, like everyone, all the way back to 2007. As I said to you, Tony, that's a hell of a streak. You know, if you were in baseball, you'd take that in a second. And I think what's also an issue, which the late Elfin Collective and the one of the solicitors they work with, a woman called Cuiva Haughey, are particularly concerned about now is that a person who will remain unnamed, I'll only say they are a former master of maternity services at one of the maternity hospitals, walked into Donnelly's office and got agreement for funding for a HSC investigative unit to consider. Basically, their job is anytime now a woman dies in childbirth, they will go in and look at the evidence to sift and work out basically how best to present it prior to it going to a public inquiry, because they don't want it looked at too much. Mm. And you're just, it's like,
Oisin, you were furious when you raised this with me. Never mind your mother. So when you think about that again, all, and I hate to put this all in the context of what we've been talking about here today, but it's all of a part of the state putting a different spin on things and representing. You know, we talked about, you know, Roderick O'Gorman's statement of, you know, we might not give you the info because you might not want to read it. You might find it uncomfortable. And this is very much a case. And as you point out, those statistics speak for themselves. And I know you're saying, I've spoken to your mother. She's a wonderful woman and she's done amazing work on this over the decades, in fact. And, you know, it really shows that still, despite all of this and why people are still concerned about, say, something as big as the National Maternity Hospital and its ownership and how it's going to be used. Why shouldn't we continue to be concerned when you know that this is the thing that is actually that is actually happening behind the scenes? So, look, we may actually come back to, and we may get your boss on to talk, Oisin, about it as things go on. But I'm glad, and look, just to even raise it today is good. So I really appreciate you coming and giving us a couple of minutes on that. It's something that we do need to pay more attention to. Before we wrap up, folks, I do want to say we will have more on Ukraine this week and more on the Northern Ireland Assembly elections. Some of the stuff coming out of the north this week, and I've spoken to, I've done four or five podcasts with candidates on that, and it's been, but some of the noise is coming out at the moment about, you know, let's not recognize a Sinn Féin first minister and things like that. There should be more attention, I believe, in our media to that, because that's anti-democratic, and this is happening right now on the island of Ireland, and we need to make sure that we're all saying, actually, if we want Stormont to work and we want to do this has to be tackled now.
I think Colin Harvey was talking there, or at least he was tweeting there during the week about the
and sorry, so one other thing, an attack on a PVP candidate in the streets.
Yeah, that's true, absolutely true. And Colin Harvey has said that the ramping up of violent language is very concerning around this election in Northern Ireland, because when you start using violent language, that eventually plays out in violent actions. And he has great concerns, and he thinks that everybody should be toning this down a little, and they should be toning it down.
Colin himself has received death threats, which were deemed to be credible by the PSNI.
I know, it's incredible. Just for literally doing what his job is. I mean, he's an academic, for God's sakes. He's not a threat to anybody.
And apologies, I did say PVP candidate. It was an SDLP candidate, as has been pointed out in the comments there. So, but no, we'll be back. We'll be covering that in some detail this week. But it could be seismic. It could be good. But when you see that, what's that Lord Kilcooley fella? Did you see what he called for? An actual, he said, if we can cause a bit of trouble on the streets, the PSNI won't be able to cope with it, and we'll need the British Army to come, and that will mean that people will want to that the provos on the nationalist side will want to react. He literally called for that on social media in a week before an election. It's shocking. And again, I come back to it. Many members of the Irish media don't really want to talk about it because it means to them that we'd have to actually acknowledge that we're not doing enough to you know, engage those communities. And again, I might have to clip this out, but we're working on a podcast coming up from hosted by the Unionist Loyalist community. So you know, we're working on that as well. So I can tell you one thing, folks, those guys like Kilcooley, you know, they're not representative of that community.
No, and I think that's our overall experience, Tony, of speaking to people on all sides in Northern Ireland. No, they're not represented. There's a lot of caricatures of people out there that are just not representative of the communities that are there. They're just not in any way representative.
Shamim, can I ask you? I know you've been trying to get a piece in the can, and today's your big day. What's coming this week?
So I'm working on a piece on how the EU Parliament keeps pushing for scrapping the golden visas or passports, you know, the immigrant investment schemes. So I'm kind of looking at how realistic it is. And it's not realistic at all for the EU Parliament to be able to enforce the abolishment of this scheme. So I'm kind of looking at why they're doing it when they can't, they don't simply have the power to do it, you know?
Oh, well, I would certainly think that what happened with the Russian visas has rattled them, because there are bigger stories than just Russian visas, Tony. I mean, particularly in Ireland, there are bigger visa stories than
They invest. Imagine turning an Irish passport into social housing. This is what's happening in this country. We are selling social housing back to ourselves on enhanced leasing, and people are coming out with
golden passports.
Yeah, it's a shocking story. It doesn't sit well with me, and our state are absolutely
knee deep, Tony.
Yeah, and Shamim, I'm glad you're covering it, because I'm looking forward to that, because it's something that we've known, but people have like kind of said, but we need the money for this sort of thing. When, you know, realistically, they're buying passports and access to the EU, which is, when you think the people who are here. I mean, imagine the fight we had just to get stamp four.
Absolutely, for doctors. Yeah, yeah, and people working in the healthcare service. I mean, it was an epic battle. And we covered that. We had great chats. But, and it is great that has progressed.
Yeah, but
you know, the idea that a Chinese millionaire can
it costs it'll cost Joella, who hosts Built Different. It's going to cost her about $1,000 to get Irish citizenship, and her here since she was Babo.
Yeah,
because of Michael McDowell's racist referendum. You know, so sorry, Shamim. Anyway, looking forward to that. Really can't wait for that. And Martin, you have stuff coming, but you're not letting me talk about it.
No, we can't. We just can't. We can't. It's that simple. But we'll talk about it lots during the week.
Yeah, we will indeed. Listen, folks, back. I actually think I'm back tomorrow, because he says he needs he only works one day every three now. So he literally said that to me this morning. Don't laugh about it now, you prick.
I work all the time. As Noel well knows, Noel, I do work all the time.
Noel, Shamim, it's been a pleasure. Oisin, thanks for joining us, and him. whatever. I'll talk, listen,
take
folks,
care of yourselves, and we shall talk to you next Sunday. Be good to yourselves.
Thank you.